Welcome to Health Hats, empowering people as they travel together toward best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege, living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in healthcare's Tower of Babel. Let's make some sense of all of this. I'm part of a project with academic, clinical, and technical experts examining the puzzle of pain management and opioid use. While participating, I often see Melissa Reynolds' words in my mind's eye. She lives with, struggles with pain. She's so sensible about pain. I met Melissa Reynolds virtually. We never chatted voice to voice, only asynchronously online. Melissa writes about fibromyalgia, chronic pain, and pregnancy, separately and together. I read her faithfully and comment more than I do with most. She has inspired me from the start. Please allow me to share Melissa's wisdom with you here.
Good evening here in Boston. And good morning in New Zealand. I'm speaking with Melissa Reynolds, who's known in cyberspace as Fibromama. Melissa, I think we met through the Chronic Illness Blogger Facebook.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I think you were looking for people to review your book, and this old white man agreed to review your book. This fellow's never been pregnant and doesn't have fibromyalgia, but I was really taken with your book, and I've been following you ever since. I'm really drawn to your pretty no-nonsense and practical about pain. The things that resonate with me that I've stolen from you are nothing works for everyone, everything works for someone, and nothing works every time. You need many pain solutions in your toolbox. And I just think that's done it for me.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to be talking with you. I want to first ask you, where were you when you first realized that health was fragile?
Well, I'm not sure it was any one place because it came on over a period of many years.
Okay.
But I don't think I realized until I was about 23 that it wasn't normal the way I was living and how hard it was. And that's when I started to really fight my doctor for a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere around then I must have had some kind of epiphany about it not being normal.
Mm-hmm. Before you had your issues, was there in your family, you know, something that might have happened or in your circle, your world, where you were thinking about health and it, the tenuousness of health before it affected you, or was it when something affected you?
I think it was always, I was so young that I think it had to be from within before I realized. And I knew that I had had pain for a long time in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But at my last semester of university, I got very sick with a very bad bug. And after that, I had extreme fatigue.
Mm.
And that's when I realized, I think, that it wasn't right. And then it kind of has taken, even until now, I'm slowly realizing all of the little things that contributed. So the fact that I wasn't eating optimally and I was very, very busy. I had, you know, a couple of jobs while at university, and I helped out with my brothers at home because they're quite a lot younger than me. And just the confluence of events, just, you know, it didn't lead to robust health.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's been an ongoing epiphany, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so now you're older and you've been through what you've been through. What do you think healthy, what is healthy? What does it mean to you now, healthy?
Well, for me, given my context of growing up basically with chronic pain and fatigue, is healthy is living the best you can within whatever your confines are, mm-hmm. and finding those the key things that everybody should live by, and following them as best you can. You know, those mm-hmm. things like good sleep and good movement and good nutrition. And I think it's just treating that balance between your context and between, you know, what it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, you really have to take your current context into account at all time.
Yeah. Mm. I imagine that you and I could talk for several hours about the subject of pain. But what I really want to do with this time that we have together is to pick your brain about the relationship between a person with chronic pain and their clinicians, and think mm-hmm. about helping how people manage that relationship so it's the best relation possible. So when I say clinicians, I'm thinking doctors, nurses, pharmacists, social workers, acupuncture, massage, you know, people who have licenses as opposed to lay people. What's been your experience managing those relationships?
It hasn't been entirely positive. There was a great many years. There were a great many years I was ignored and treated like a hypochondriac, mm-hmm. or like my symptoms were made up, mm-hmm. when actually what I was telling them were, you know, classic fibromyalgia symptoms. Mm-hmm. So it took me a long time to gather any clinicians that I could trust.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my work has been done in isolation from them, which is a shame because it could have been so much faster.
Mm-hmm.
But even the clinicians I've touched base with since I have brought myself to this level of wellness has been disappointing, which really upsets me for everybody else. But the ones that I have had a good relationship with, I'm so thankful for.
And so what makes that good relationship?
It's that willingness to work with you, to believe you wholeheartedly, and the willingness to say, well, I'm not really sure what to do, but I'm really happy to figure this out with you. So my current GP, he's got good experience with fibromyalgia and chronic pain and good experience with alternative therapies, but he never really had anything specific for me to try. But he was so supportive, and I remember when I brought him my research about low-dose naltrexone, I brought him these reams of research and I was prepared to talk him into it because I'd done so much research. And he's like, sure, great. Can I have a copy of this research? And he was so happy to to have my research. And so, yeah, that's just been how our relationship has worked. And so when I was pregnant last year and had severe pelvis issues, and I went to him and I said, look, this is really, really bad. And he knew what my context was. So he knew that when I'm telling him it's bad, it's pretty bad. And he put me off work immediately. I didn't have to fight or go through those awful processes I see women in my group having to go through just to get some recognition and support.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of intangible. I don't even know how, you know, a doctor would learn that sort of thing.
I have a neurologist that sounds like his rap is always, you know, I know about drugs and therapeutics for MS, but I don't know crap about you. And my job mm-hmm. is to learn about you and, you know, what's important to you. And, you know, when I met this guy, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. And then when he moved away, I was like mm-hmm. devastated. And I sort of auditioned some neurologist, and then, you know, I fired, you know, it didn't work out. I fired him, you know, went on to try somebody else. So you didn't go obviously directly to ideal GP.
No.
So how did you, like, was it hard for you at first to say, oh, this one, forget it. He's got nothing or she's got nothing and I got to go somewhere else. Like, what was that process like for you?
Again, it took a really long time. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that I had permission to do that. Mm-hmm. I thought the doctor was going to be the one that fixed me. And because the doctor had nothing, I just had to live like that. So my first GP, I mean, she saw me on and off for years and years and years and didn't do anything. And when I took her the article about fibromyalgia that someone had sent me, she checked the tender points and said, oh yeah, it's fibromyalgia, and didn't do anything else. And the only other thing I recall from her is when I was saying, look, I have this idea that if I could reduce my work hours, mm-hmm. I might create some space and feel a bit better. And she always discouraged that. She said, no, you'll just have, you know, less money, but still be in that much pain and you'll be disappointed. She was so wrong. That was the best thing I ever did. But when I came, when I made my big move and my big shift and started working less, I had a GP who, she wasn't dismissive, but again, she just really didn't get it. And I only left her because I moved. And so I accidentally had to change doctors. And I knew that this doctor was not right because I went to her. I said, look, I've got severe fatigue. I've got a little baby to look after. What on earth can I do? And she said, have more salt.
Oh.
And I said, you are not going to help me. And so that's when I changed GPs and found the one I've got.
Mm-hmm. If you're anything like, I think, it's not just a GP that you see, that there are other clinicians that you see, whether they're medical people or not medical people. So how have you built relationships with them or found them?
Yeah. It's, again, it is a long, long process of trial and error and trying to figure it out. So, and that's the unfortunate thing, and that's why I share everything on my blog, because I just don't want it to be such a long, painful process for others. But I just slowly learned what worked for me and what I needed. Mm-hmm. So after many years of going to many different physical therapists, for example, I learned that I needed a specific type of treatment. And I didn't actually learn until 2017 that it was myofascial pain syndrome and trigger points. But there's these two trigger points right up in the base of my head. Mm-hmm. That if they don't get treated, I get severe headaches and very sick and dizzy. Mm. And I learned by accident what I needed. And so when I was auditioning new physiotherapists over this side, when we moved, I knew what I was asking for. And when I would meet someone and they were resistant to me telling them what I needed, I knew that they weren't for me.
Yeah.
Or I would call and I'd be like, okay, I need to be really sure that what you're doing is not this. And so, for example, have you ever heard of dry needling?
Yeah.
So that intramuscular needling is what I need, but a lot of them will either just jab it in or push it in and purposely jiggle it around for a spasm, which flares up your central nervous system, which I do not need. Mm-hmm. And so I would be very clear on the phone that this is not what I need. I need them to just put the needle in and leave it gently. I need gentle treatments. And so many people I called and checked, and then I go in and see them, and that's not what they would do. But then I met a physiotherapist who was willing. She wasn't trained in that, but she was willing to give it a go. So she was an acupuncturist. And I said, but I want you to put the needle into the trigger point. And so she learned about those trigger points and put them in for me. And that started to make a real difference. Mm-hmm. But when she left, a more experienced physio came. And so she was not only willing to do that, but she, that's already was her practice.
Oh.
And we learned together what I needed her to do. And so for the last 2 years, I've been seeing her and it's been just amazing. I tell her exactly what I need. Every time I go, we have like a congress of what I've learned and what she's learned. And yeah, it's been really empowering and very exciting, but all that knowledge is hard won and took a long time.
Yes. How would you advise people who are early on? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is what you already, you know, blog about and write about, but how can people proactively, it seems to me that some trial and error is just, that's part of learning. And you sort of need to do that for yourself. But there's something about a supportive community that gives you the courage to try, to speak up and try stuff and, you know, not be satisfied. So what have you learned as you're working with younger people who are, well, I don't know that I necessarily mean younger, but I mean newer in the journey.
Yeah.
How do you advise, like, what do you recommend to them?
So when I'm first, I mean, if I get, it's really hard because if I'm coaching someone, I get the ability to talk to them and ask them questions and really dig into it. Mm-hmm. So it's much harder when I'm just writing on my blog, you know, general suggestions.
Right.
But the first thing you need to do is be really aware of where your pain is originating, because you need to be aware of what is going on so that you can then figure out what might help it. So, for example, for fibromyalgia, they say there's no physical cause of the pain. You can't feel why there's pain or where there's pain, and therefore treatments aren't supposed to help. Whereas in myofascial pain syndrome, you have actual trigger points. You can feel them. The therapist can feel them. The therapist can see when you are having a spasm. And so it's quite a different ball game. Mm-hmm. Actually, the one thing I really love about the myofascial pain syndrome is it's a little bit easier to treat in that you can really know where you need to go for the pain, you know, where it's originating. But you have to be really aware of what your pain is, what is causing it, and then you can figure out what might treat it. But unfortunately, it's not as simple as saying, okay, well, I have trigger points, so this will work. Because the physical therapy and the physical treatments of your pain is just the tip of the iceberg. If you want anything to work, you've got to be working on perpetuating factors. You've got to be working on the central nervous system dysfunction. You've got to be sleeping. Nothing's going to help if you're not sleeping. So unfortunately, there's no easy fix. And so, yeah, it's really hard to tell people early on, I'm so sorry, but there's a ginormous puzzle of things you have to do, and each of those puzzle pieces are deep down.
I appreciate what you're saying. In my language, I would say, I want to love myself, and I want to be at one with the pain, and I want to explore it as much as I can. And this is me. And I'm good. And language is so inadequate sometimes to describe pain.
Yes.
And to, you know, like you just said, you know, whether there are triggers, whether there are other factors. Very fortunate for me, one of the things that works more than anything is drink more water. I mean, I just can't stand it, how much that works. One out of four times, one out of, you know, three times. I mean, a lot.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's just so simple. See the show notes or my website, www.health-hats.com, for more information or to subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. I guess I think that one of the things that's really hard, you know, I don't know about the medical system in New Zealand. I don't know much about it, but there just isn't time to do that work with a licensed professional, because they get paid by the unit, whether it's the visit or the session or whatever. And solving a puzzle, which is what it is, it takes more than the time there is. So is that a issue where you are as well?
Yeah. And even if they had time, I don't know if they would necessarily be able to do it anyway. I don't think they have the knowledge. So yeah, wherever your healthcare system is, you have to be in charge of utilizing your doctor and your professionals as well as possible. And so that's why I think the two most important people in your healthcare team are you And then potentially a coach or someone like that who can kind of help you project manage the whole thing because it is a project.
Yeah. My language, I think about it, and I don't mean my language, English versus whatever. I mean, I think about a care partner. For me, that's my wife.
Yeah.
But I do think that I agree that those are the two most important people in my health team, me and my care partner, because when I feel like crap, I'm kind of useless. And really when it comes to me in general, like I'm way better with other people, you know, than I am with myself. Okay. I guess that was going to be another question, but we're already talking about it, which is like, who else is on your team? That, you know, it isn't just the professional. So you have a coach. I have a care partner. I guess I have a bunch of coaches.
Yeah. Coach isn't necessarily someone who calls themselves a coach.
Right.
Okay. Though I actually don't have a coach for fibromyalgia because I haven't actually met anyone more experienced than myself in the areas I need them to be experienced in. So I dabble with coaches in a different way, but I've never actually had a care partner. Mm-hmm. I've been my team the whole time. And so sometimes I sub in consults. So with my GP or my physiotherapist, I've tried a naturopath. That didn't go so well.
A naturopath. Yeah. Okay.
And I've tried all sorts of things, but it's basically I'm the project manager and I sub in people sometimes, but ultimately it's all on me and always has been. And that's why I trained to be a coach, because I know that back at the beginning when I started to fight, when I realized I wasn't that person for me, and it took me several years to become that. And if I could have had that several years ago, it would have been a much shorter fight. It would have saved me a lot of time and energy and vulnerability and just plain being miserable, because that's what we need. I don't care what they're called, whether it's a care partner or a doctor or, you know, counselor, it's anybody who can kind of help you. Yeah. Someone who can say, okay, well, we've got lots of strands here. We've got to work through it. I'll keep you motivated to keep going. Yeah. But I think ultimately, no matter who's on your team, you've got to be the main person. You've got to be the cheerleader, because no one's more invested than you are.
Yeah. So we've been talking about relationships in this. What about data? What about, how do you use information, whether it's your medical information or your tracking stuff, or how do you use that?
So in terms of tracking my health and my data, at first it was all very accidental. I'd get blood reports, and so I just keep them and look back at them. Then I started formulating my own kind of sheets to track, you know, my progress, and then I realized that they probably were useful, and so I turned them into a bit more of a pretty version. And so I have some of them free on my blog, and some of them I sell in an Etsy store. It's just that you've got to watch the data and track it over time and notice how things change. And you have, because there's so many strands and so many things to try in so many areas, you have to keep an eye on it. And you also have to write down a list of everything you've tried, because when brain fog is an issue, you can't remember. I've tried tons of things. I do not remember how they worked.
Yes.
But also there's things I would like to retry now that I'm in a better position in my health, because they might be able to actually work, because more subtle things are helping now that I've made some real progress.
Like sleep.
Sleep is humongous. I could talk to you for hours about sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Once you start sleeping, you can work, you can chip away at the more subtle things. It's amazing. We'll go way off course if I go there. But yeah, you do have to keep an eye on it. And I mean, I've been watching the research for a long time. I've been reading a thousand things over the time. So you've just got to write it all down and keep a track of it.
Mm-hmm. And do you, is that, you do that on paper, you have, you use spreadsheets, you, what form does that take? You said you sell something on Etsy and on your website. I will put your information on the show notes. So if people want to, yeah, sure.
I made templates, okay. But it got more formal as I had more energy. So at first I was just kind of wading water, and then I just would start writing things down. Mm-hmm. And then I got more, you know, as I had more ability, I was able to write things down. And then I started playing on the computer. And so now it's just that little bit more formal, mm-hmm. You know, like the templates and things. But mostly I am a pen and paper type person. I've tried all sorts of apps and things to track stuff. I'm just not a big fan of that. Mm-hmm. Same with project management software. I just like a good tick list on a piece of paper.
Yeah. Well, that's technology. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in our email exchange setting this up, I told you that one of the gigs I have is with people who are developing clinical decision support tools, hang on, to help with the process. And yes. I guess I'm really underwhelmed. You know, I'm I call myself an informaticist, and what that means is I'm really familiar with electronic health records. I've been the project manager for several electronic health record implementations. I download, I'm going to say hundreds, but I'm probably exaggerating, tens of apps, and you know, try them out. I'm sort of with you. I have a spreadsheet. Yeah. And, you know, that, you know, it's an Excel spreadsheet, and that's the best thing. But I don't really that well keep track of what hasn't worked. You know, like I do keep track of books I already read because I'll forget and start reading them again, you know, and so I realize that I have to keep a list. But oddly enough, I don't do that for symptom management. Which seems kind of nuts now that I'm talking to you. What should I be asking you that I'm not?
In terms of keeping track of things?
No. In terms of your odyssey of managing your pain. Like if you, I mean, I don't want to talk for two more hours, even though I'd love it. I want to. My wife's going to be home soon and I want to make dinner, but yeah, if you were going to, there was like a couple of points that you really thought ought to be in the podcast for people who care. What do you think?
Well, do you know what? If there's one thing I'm ever allowed to tell people, it's that you can make a difference and you can improve your life. And the other thing is that it's going to be through knowledge. You're going to have to inform yourself and you're going to have to do some work. So it's within, you know, your hands, basically. Mm-hmm. Because it broke my heart when I did a poll and asked people if they had ever tried anything other than the medicines their doctor gave them. And more hadn't than had. So these people didn't even know simple things like using their heat pack or having an Epsom salt bath, or, you know, all they had was this medicine their doctors gave them. And it breaks my heart because what happens then when they're pregnant is their doctors say, okay, you're not allowed that anymore. You're going to have nothing. And then they take them off it and then wonder why they're struggling. But if you know, if you have the power, if you've made your decisions and done your research, mm-hmm. then you're in a better position to make those choices for yourself. Because I always say that the cost versus benefit scenario, especially when you're pregnant as well with medicine, you have to be part of that equation. Your quality of life counts.
Yeah, and your quality of life depends on it.
Yes, your quality of life, you're not a martyr, and you deserve to control your symptoms, whatever the situation. And sometimes you might make a decision you're comfortable with, and that means you're living with more pain for a temporary time, and that's fine. But if you've made that decision with knowledge and you're aware, and then you have also put in the other things in place, you know, if you've gone through and worked on your natural pain relief mechanisms, for example, you will have made such a difference to your quality of life, because that power is really crucial. That knowing that you have control, it changes the way you think of things. If you're sitting there thinking that things are being done to you and you can't do anything, it just is not going to help you. And I believe it kind of sinks into the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, when I, this neurologist that I loved, one of the things that he said, you know, was, I really need to know what's important to you. And, you know, so I said, you know, so I went home and, you know, had a conversation with my family and thinking about it, you know, and it was, you know, some pretty basic, I want to progress as slowly as possible. I don't want to mess with my pathological optimism. I want to keep playing the saxophone.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and he said, well, I can work with that. And so when we were looking at, you know, when we were exploring treatment options, he would say, well, or I would say to him, well, is that going to affect my pathological optimism? Mm-hmm. You know, he said, well, it might. And I said, well, then I want to try something else. And he said, well, I don't know that much about it. But if you, you know, come to me with something, we can do it. And I think with what you're saying is, you know, the feeling like I'm in control, that I can, like, this is okay. I can handle this.
Yeah.
You know, this I can't handle, but this I can. I think that the control piece is, So I think what I'm hearing for you is knowledge, experimentation, keeping track of it. Yeah.
And it's your choice what you're working towards, whether you're working towards better functionality or better symptom management, whatever that balance is, that's up to you. A lot of the research for a long time was all about functionality. People wanted you to be able to walk a certain distance, but they didn't care if your pain was less. And I actually fired a physio because he said to me that he had someone walking for an hour every day by the end of a year, but his back pain level hadn't changed. And the physio decided that was success. And I said, no.
Yeah.
That I do not subscribe to that, because does that person consider it success? Because there's no need for him to walk an hour each day. Like, the, you know, cardiovascular health is 30 minutes. That's enough. So why are you forcing him to walk an hour when his back pain is not changing? How are you defining that as success? So I think it's up to us whether we are looking for what that ratio is, you know, what that looks like for us, symptom level versus functionality. And I think that's really cool that your neurologist had that frame of mind. Sounded like a good one.
yes. Yeah, I'm very fortunate. I have a really good team. I have a physical therapist who, actually, over 10 years, I've probably seen her five times, but she specializes in Parkinson's and MS. And so after the initial, giving me an initial program, I don't need somebody, I can do my own program, you know, but when I progressed and I was falling more or whatever, you know, I would go back to her and get a tune-up, you know, review the program. You know, I went from one cane to two canes. Now I use an electric wheelchair some of the time, you know, when I'm traveling, but I, you know, so I've only really not seen her that often, but she's a critical person because I know it's progressive and I'm going to need her again. And knowing that somebody has, you know, understands. So I wasn't going to ask you this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So one of the things that is really interesting to me, and I'm considering doing my next series of podcasts, is what you're talking about in terms of being the captain of your own ship and having, well, let's just take that. I'm sort of appalled at how unready people are for that. You know what I mean? It's like, so I work with people who they're, I mean, I don't really work directly with people who are sick anymore, but I work with the people who help people who are sick. It is frightening to me how unprepared people are to be the captain of their own ship, you know, the ship being their health, which is a lot of what you're talking about. So what's your experience with that? Is that part of the work that you do, is helping people become ready?
My aim through everything I write is for people to see what can happen when you take control.
Okay.
So basically I give as many tips and tricks and things as possible, but all of the things I suggest, they have to do the work. Whether it is going to see a specific doctor, whether it is researching an option, whether it is drinking more water or stretching or going for a walk, it is things they have to do. And I try to make it clear that they do have to start doing the work. But I will not take the work to the next level. I won't work with a client who doesn't already fully believe that they have that power to change their quality of life and who hasn't already started. So if they don't have a list of things that they've already tried, if they don't talk in those kind of proactive terms, then I can't work with them like that, because they're not ready and they're not going to get benefit. I can't, if someone is just going to listen and say, oh yeah, that sounds good, but not do anything, then they're not going to make any progress.
Yeah.
And that's just a waste of everybody's time and energy. I want people to know that they can be proactive.
You know, two thoughts. One is that I really feel for doctors in some ways. And I saw it a lot when I was a practicing nurse, is that those people who aren't taking charge, they're there. And it's our job to take care of them. And so I agree that it's a two-way street, and there's a clear role for everybody. The other thing is that this physical therapist I was telling you about, she told me a few years ago that she thinks, I might have these numbers wrong, but they're in the ballpark, that a third of the people she treats does anything she recommends after she recommends it. And that I'm the only person after 10 years is still doing what she recommended. And I think that is really disheartening to hear that.
Yeah.
So that's on us.
That's not us. And I didn't realize, I think I'd been quite insulated because I'm only in very proactive groups, like on Facebook, and I only talk with the type of people I talk with. And I didn't realize that the people I deal with and who are proactively seeking solutions and helping themselves, I didn't realize we were a small proportion. I didn't realize how many people just don't try anything. Yeah,
it just makes me want to cry. I mean, it's so that's a lot of needless suffering.
I know, right? Yes. It's really upsetting because these doctors, you can't bemoan the doctor because actually, I mean, the doctor can say things to you, but you've got to do it. The doctor can't do that work for you. So it's always going to come to you, whether you take the recommendation of your doctor or the recommendation of someone else, or you find it yourself. You've got to do the work, and you've got to realize that something is going on in your body and it's just not going to magically get better.
It's lovely talking to you.
Yeah.
I'm delighted that I'm actually seeing you and not just that photo of you. Thank you for inspiring me.
Oh my God. Thank you.
Yeah. So have a good one.
You as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Bye.
Fibromyalgia is an invisible illness. We all vary greatly in revealing the inside of our bodies and our minds, even to ourselves. We all have invisible selves. Many have invisible illnesses. Most of us, what goes on inside, is invisible to others. Most of us is visible to some, if we're lucky and safe, and do the work. Do the work, as Melissa talks about, niggles at my mind. I want to respect people that don't do the work and don't know there's work to be done. I want there to be solutions for everyone. That's equity. Solutions to manage pains, to improve function, to nudge us towards best health. But my goodness, we're so different. Not only is there no one-size-fit-all, there may also be many potential solutions for everyone. So, who's the audience here? Is the audience a small proportion that needs to do the work and be captain of CEO of their health? There's no other way for them. They gotta do it. Like Melissa and me and maybe you. Then there's some who want to do the work, but don't know how to do the work. They need a map, a guide, a coach, a partner. Then there's the largest percentage that doesn't know that they can do the work and be captain of their own ship. For the don't know group, we could plant a seed that might germinate under the right alignment. Melissa doesn't work with people who aren't doing the work. She can't. Now that makes sense for her. Her kind of coaching is pretty intimate. She opens her heart. That can be exhausting. I've been molding a new series for this podcast. How can you serve the must, the don't know how, and the don't know yet audiences? How can we support them in the journey together towards best health? No matter their age, genetics, social circumstances, physical environment, medical condition. Goodness, I feel like I'm a bit stoned saying all this, but I'm on to something. Follow my blog, podcasts, and resources through my website. See you around the block.